We do welcome you to this centennial celebration. I was pleased and honored when the committee, which had been at work planning for this series of services and other events in commemoration of this centennial, asked me to fulfill this particular charge and responsibility to speak at this hour to the issue of the first 50 years of Southern Seminary's doctoral program. Such an historical review is always full of reaffirmations and surprises. This is an institution with a priceless inheritance in terms of its heritage. To unmine that heritage and to find its treasures is both a privilege and a joy. The celebrated emigre and historian John Lukacs reminds us that centuries are not what they may first appear to be, that centuries should not be measured so much by numerals, but by events, something which the ancient Hebrews would certainly have understood. Centuries should not be marked so much by numbers and years, but by the significant shaping events which have changed the world. A closer look, Lukacs suggests, is required in order to understand when a century begins and when it ends. It may be 100 years in length, it may be something more, or something less. In his recent book, The End of the 20th Century and the End of the Modern Age, Lukacs argues, and I quote, "The 20th century is now over. It was a short century. It lasted 75 years, from 1914 to 1989. Its two main events were the two world wars. They were the enormous mountain ranges that dominated its entire landscape. The Russian Revolution, the atomic bomb, the end of the colonial empires, the establishment of communist states, the dominion of the two world superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, the division of Europe and of Germany, all of these were the consequences of the two world wars in the shadow of which we have been living until now. The 19th century lasted 99 years, from 1815 to 1914, from the end of Napoleon's wars to the start of the First World War. The 18th century lasted 126 years, from the beginning of the world wars between England and France, of which the American War of Independence was a part, until their end at Waterloo. The 17th century lasted 101 years, from the destruction of the Spanish Armada in 1588, to 1689, the year after the so-called Glorious Revolution in England, when the main threat to England became France and no longer Spain. Centuries are not always what they appear to be. They are marked not just by numerals, but by these significant shaping events. We gather here to mark the centennial of the doctoral program at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. As it stands, it almost spans the 20th century. The century, John Lukacs argues, is already over. It seems a long time ago, 1894. It is now distant. Our vision of it is somewhat ephemeral. It is an era which evokes what President Abraham Lincoln referred to as the mystic chords of memory. In 1894, when Southern Seminary awarded its first doctoral degrees, Grover Cleveland, the reformer from Buffalo, was president of the United States. William Gladstone was prime minister of Great Britain. Queen Victoria was still ruling over her empire on which the sun never set. In that year, Rudyard Kipling wrote The Jungle Book. Bernard Shaw wrote Arms and the Man, and Sibelius composed Finlandia. It was in that year that the plague bacillus was discovered, as was also argon gas. Items, I'm sure, that are very keen to your memory. It was a year unmarked, however, by great world convolutions. At Southern Seminary, James P. Boyce was dead, as was Bansley Manley Jr., William Williams. John A. Broadus, the last of the surviving founders, was president, and he would be dead within the year. The faculty included, in addition to Dr. Broadus, William Whitsett, John R. Sampey, F. H. Kerfoot, A. T. Robertson, and Edwin Charles Dargan. Dr. Sampey and Dr. Robertson were both 31 years of age. Within the year, Dr. Broaddus will perish, and Professor Whitsitt will become the third president of this institution. This was the first great transitional period in the life of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. In this era, we see the shift from the founders to the era of Mullins, not yet on the horizon. When Southern Seminary was founded in 1859, it was a unique model for a theological institution, unique in many ways, but it can be seen perhaps most clearly as a cross between the strengths of Princeton Seminary, drawing from that institution its theological heritage and classical model of theological education, but also that of the University of Virginia, with its elective system and democratic impulse. From 1859 until 1892, no formal degrees were issued or conferred by this institution. Those who completed courses of study were known either as graduates, English graduates, or full graduates. This goes back to the founding vision of the institution as articulated in 1856 and Dr. Boyce's famous address, Three Changes in Theological Institutions, his inaugural address delivered at Furman University, the Magna Carta of this institution. The three changes, as you will remember, that Dr. Boyce called for were open admissions, so that all those whom God had called into ministry may study at their appropriate level. No longer would a classical education be required with years of preparation in Greek and Latin, because unfortunately that precluded the study in this institution, or any theological institution of that day, of the vast majority of Southern Baptist preachers. Reflecting on this, it was Dr. Sampey who said that until 1859, not one of Jesus' 12 disciples could have gained entry into a theological seminary in the United States of America. But if that was the first impulse of this institution, the second, as articulated by President Boyce, was that this would be an institution of scholarly aspiration and practical application. It is that issue which was in many ways the root for what would become the doctoral program in this institution. The third change Dr. Boyce called for was confessional accountability as represented in the abstract of principles. Dr. Boyce was concerned for a seminary that would produce scholars in the service of the church. This was an era in which no Southern institution yet produced that kind and quality of scholar. It was an era in which no Baptist institution yet aspired to produce such a class of scholars in the service of the church. Dr. Boyce was not concerned merely with academic and scholarly aspiration, but also with the application of learning, consecrated godly learning, in the pulpit and in the pastorate. In his address, he warned of an institution that would produce educated men, but not educated ministers. Rooted in Dr. Boyce's message is a dissatisfaction and a concern. He hoped to see indigenous American, Protestant, Baptist, evangelical scholarship. In his address, Dr. Boyce spoke of this satisfaction in these words, and I quote, "The dissatisfaction to which I refer has been awakened by the inadequate extent to which all theological institutions have pursued their studies, and the consequent lack among us of the scholarship which prevails in some countries abroad. It has been felt as a sore evil that we have been dependent in great part upon the criticism of Germany for all the more learned investigations in biblical criticism and exegesis, and that in the study of the development of the doctrine of the church, as well as of its outward progress, we have been compelled to depend upon works in which much error has been mingled with truth, owing to the defective standpoint occupied by their authors. And although the disadvantages of American scholars have been realized as arising from the want of adequate theological libraries, as well as from the inaccessible nature of much other material, it has been felt that it has also been in part due to the limited extent to which the study of theological science has been pursued among us. We have been much dependent upon others, and unable to push forward investigations for ourselves, and even so inadequately acquainted with the valuable results of others who have accomplished the work for us. Only a few, perhaps, have participated in this sentiment, but the evil which awakens it is not, therefore, the less momentous. These words from Dr. Boyce remind us of the urgency on his heart which God used to give birth to this institution, and it was an urgency which identified a scholarly gap, the dire need on behalf of the churches, even when they did not know nor perceive that need for scholarship in their own service. He was also concerned that this scholarship be consecrated and be convictional. He explicitly suggests that one of the reasons the churches need this focused, Christian, dedicated scholarship is because if it is done by others, it may be done with grave error. For the first 33 years of Southern Seminary's history, no titled degrees were awarded. Dr. Boyce, in his address, issued no call for degrees, but it reflected a serious and heartfelt call for consecrated scholarship in the service of the churches. We see in his words a defense of the faith and a defense of the Baptists, but it was also an apology and a call for scholarship. Southern Seminary was reluctant to award degrees because it did not want to be misunderstood. Nor did it want, as an institution, to create a class of titled ministers that would be a scourge, a detriment to the church. It was with great reluctance that this institution moved towards the acceptance of degrees. The seminary, its faculty and trustees, wanted to ensure that such would meet the ideals of the institution. They did not want to foster the creation of an academic elite. They did not want ministers who trusted in titles rather than in the truth. They feared misunderstanding both within and without the institution. In 1882, the faculty petitioned the trustees for guidance in this matter. Other institutions were beginning to award entitled degrees with recognized names and initials. The faculty did not make an explicit proposal to the trustees. Instead, they turned to the trustees for guidance, and the response of the trustees through their committee of 1882 is most revealing. Their report stated the need of the great body of the rising generation is not erudition, but rather a good working knowledge of the sacred writings of the theological and ethical system inculcated in the divine word, of the paramount facts and main drifts of church history, and of homiletics and pastoral duties. The leading object of the seminary must be the culture of the great body of the students in just these particulars, and thus the preparation of pastors and teachers for their life work. Provision, however, should be made as far as practicable for the education of an important but more limited class, and we have reason for thankfulness in the fact that our professors are qualified to address themselves to this undertaking, to conduct a larger course of study than that required for preachers, to train scholars and professors and render service to the cause of Christ in their own special and dignified sphere. It would, we think, be inadvisable to give to this specialty the name of the higher course, a title which may seem to deprecate the regular course pursued by the great body of the students. We would propose instead that the designation postgraduate course, which would not be liable to that objection, be used. Too great care cannot be taken in keeping the fundamental idea of the seminary as a school for preachers, distinct before the students and the denomination at large. Upon a loyal consecration to this end depends the hope, perhaps even the life, of our cherished institution. Thus, Southern Seminary awarded no prizes, no entitled degrees for its first 33 years. These degrees were to be avoided in order to preclude confusion, elitism, and misperceptions of the seminary's purpose. Yet you will also note in that very same report, the trustees encouraged the faculty to give due and diligent attention to the training of scholars for the church. As the seminary shifted from its antebellum founding and Reconstruction struggles, it emerged in the so-called Gilded Age, ready to be associated with other academic theological institutions. And it was in 1892, the year when the doctoral program here was established, but 2 years before any student would graduate, that this institution standardized its degrees. They were four, The Th.G., graduate in theology. The Th.B., bachelor of theology. The Th.M., master of theology. And the Th.D., doctor in theology. The theology graduate was anyone who had passed any course. Not a policy we intend to follow in the future. The bachelor of theology was for those who graduated in the courses in English Bible. They were no longer the English graduate, which after all could be misunderstood, but they were now bachelors of theology. The master of theology would be the one who graduated having passed both junior and senior courses in Greek and Hebrew. The doctor of theology is not perhaps what you would expect. I read here from the action of the trustees. We then propose a fourth degree. Any student who, after becoming a master of theology, shall spend in the seminary at least one full session of 8 months in study and has passed in at least 5 special classes which the catalog offers outside of the general course, and who furthermore and especially presents to the faculty an elaborate and satisfactory thesis showing new and valuable research and original and valuable thoughts upon some topic of theological inquiry, shall receive the title of Ph.D. or Doctor of Theology, a title somewhat corresponding to the Ph.D. or Doctor of Philosophy, as in some institutions. One who wishes to make a special study of Old Testament or New Testament, church history or theology, can select a number of special classes to that subject and devote his thesis to a corresponding topic, and will then receive the Ph.D. upon his proposed specialty. Trustee minutes from May the 6th, 1892. I would draw your attention to certain interesting clauses in this action. The student was to present to the faculty an elaborate and satisfactory thesis, no mere thesis. And it was to have in this thesis a demonstration of new and valuable research upon both original and valuable thoughts. I draw your attention to those issues because it reflects the emergence of the doctoral tradition in American higher education as drawn largely from German models. The attention of this institution from the founding of this degree to original and valuable research, a commitment which has continued through the doctoral program to this present day. The historical background is important. The first doctoral degree was issued by the University of Bologna in the 12th century. By 1947, U.S. institutions awarded over 3,000 doctorates per year. By 1987, U.S. institutions award over 30,000 doctoral degrees per year in over 500 distinct fields in over 47 doctoral degrees. Throughout the medieval era, the term master and doctor were largely amorphous, undefined, and somewhat interchangeable. Thus also were the respective degrees. Furthermore, and closer to home and closer to our own era, when first awarded in the United States, the Ph.D. was, in the words of one close observer, and I quote, without stable form and void of integrity, end quote. It was often honorary. It was often awarded in both honorary and earned forms without degree by the same institution. In 1861, Yale University awarded the first earned Ph.D., and over the next decade, it awarded 90% of all earned doctorates that were awarded in the United States. It was followed in 1870 by the University of Pennsylvania, in 1875 by Columbia University, which, interestingly enough, established a Ph.D. through its School of Mines, a school which no longer exists there in Manhattan. Harvard University followed in 1873 with a Ph.D. requiring graduate work of 2 years, but no thesis. Between 1866 and 1896, Princeton University awarded 20 earned Ph.D. degrees, but at the same time awarded 67 honorary Ph.D.s. Standardization of the degree followed the establishment of American graduate education with the founding of Johns Hopkins University in 1876. The German influence was powerful, much eclipsing that of the British institutions. Emphasis upon research and instruction commingled within the same institution. The German influence suggested that research must be an essential component of any doctoral program. Lofty goals of scholarship were established. The development of other models led to increasing standardization as Harvard, Yale, Clark University, and the University of Chicago took the lead in codifying and standardizing graduate education and doctoral degrees. Time does not permit elaboration of this process today, but it is important that we understand the cultural context of rising educational aspiration, even in the South. As Southern Seminary established its doctoral program, it was because there was recognized a want of qualified, consecrated, dedicated, and credentialized teachers, both for this institution itself and for sister institutions, graduate and undergraduate, throughout the South. Also, there was the theme and context of urbanization, progressive impulse toward learning and the application of that learning, and the need for teachers, both in educational institutions and for superbly trained preachers and teachers of the word, especially in urban and metropolitan pulpits. The doctoral degree at Southern Seminary has developed steadily, if sometimes awkwardly. From 1894 to 1909, we see a period of great continuity in the founding of the degree. The prerequisites were the Bachelor of Arts or the Master of Arts and a Southern Seminary THM. The requirement was basically 8 months of resident study. By the turn of the century, the seminary required one major course of study in two minor areas, a two-hour oral examination before the faculty committee, and a thesis of not less than 12,000 words. Not less than 12,000 words. This amounts in some cases to well under 50 handwritten pages. The criteria established in the catalog were thoroughness of research, originality of thought, good literary form, and the thesis, and this was underlined, became the property of the seminary if accepted. If it were not accepted, it was the property of the student. In 1922, the seminary added increased Hebrew and Greek requirements to its doctoral candidates, and the thesis was enlarged to a minimum of 20,000 words. In 1928, the shift towards the identification with the larger academic community can be traced. This was what educational specialists have referred to as the era of standardization. The trustees approved the faculty recommendation to change the degree Doctor of Theology to Doctor of Philosophy. The recommendation was accepted, trustee minutes record, and I quote, after promiscuous discussion, end quote. In 1932, the seminary required that all of its doctoral candidates have a working knowledge of Greek, Hebrew, Latin, and French or German, and in this it also parallels the development of the doctoral program and the PhD degree in the larger academic community. The seminary held itself to the standards of the elite graduate schools of the day. This is illustrated perhaps best in 1938 when Professors W.O. Carver and Hershey Davis were appointed a committee of two. Dr. Carver, by the way, was the first PhD graduate of this institution to serve on its faculty. They were commissioned as a study of two to study the standardization of the PhD degree in American universities to compare and contrast Southern's degree, and they were authorized to take and to make whatever travel was necessary. Upon their recommendation in 1939, the PhD was changed back to the THD. It was to be shifted back to the PhD some 40 years later. The early doctoral dissertations tell us much about the times, the faculty, the interests, the students, and the issues of the day. In 1894, in the first doctoral class, four graduates were presented with the degree Doctor of Theology. They were Weston Bruner, Grant Hulsh, Thomas Polhill Stafford, and Dexter Gooch Weddinghill. His name first by alphabetical order, Weston Bruner became the first individual to receive a doctoral degree from this institution. His thesis was entitled, A Query in Baptist History, the Philadelphia Association. Was it in its organization in early history strictly Calvinistic? He turned it in, and Professor Whitsitt turned it out. In the margins of this thesis, we can see much about Professor Whitsitt as well as about Dr. Bruner. Dr. Whitsitt did approve the thesis, but he suggested if it were ever to see the light of day in print, the first chapter should be removed. The thesis types are heavily weighted in classical, biblical, historical, and theological studies, and those topics predominate. With pride, we can reflect on a legacy of serious and scholarly research, analysis, and reflection. If we look to these theses and realize that they do not meet our modern expectations, we should acknowledge that they did meet or exceed the standards of their own day. The emphasis upon classical theological disciplines continued, but in the years to come were added topics related to missions, ethics, and Christian sociology. My charge has been to bring the account up to 1944, the midpoint in the century of this institution's doctoral study. The trajectories of the first 50 years would be traced throughout the next half century, but that must await tomorrow. What should we learn from the first half century? I would suggest first we should see that throughout this period, the seminary was true to its founding purpose. Its founding mission was to train, to educate, and to prepare God-called ministers of the gospel for service in the churches. It was not to be an independent graduate school. It was not to be merely a professional school. It was not focused upon an elite. It was focused upon the churches. The doctoral program did not emerge from this institution, nor within this institution, with the goal of doing anything other than serving the needs of Southern Baptist churches. Secondly, Southern Seminary has aspired to serious and substantial theological research. The topics reveal a body of knowledge. The theses vastly increased the body of written Southern Baptist theological reflection. As a matter of fact, by the time the doctoral program had reached half century, I believe it can be argued that the written material produced by the doctoral program probably exceeded most of the written and published Baptist material which had preceded it. The goal was to produce preachers and teachers. Thirdly, Southern Seminary held itself to the highest standards of both confessional fidelity and academic excellence. These were to be held in tandem, not in tension. Fourth, the doctoral program became a magneto within the institution, which strengthened the seminary as a whole and energized it. The doctoral program was not a drain, but an engine of research and a source of teachers and scholarship. Fifth, as had been recognized, Southern Seminary pioneered the model of a theological university and set that model to be emulated by scores of other institutions. The doctoral course in American higher education has not been without its critics, but it has clearly been one of the most important innovations in American scholarship. In 1911, William James at Harvard wrote of, quote, the PhD octopus, in which he warned of higher education overtaken by the tentacles of this beast. He spoke of institutions which traded the quality of their instruction for the initials in their catalogs. He said of these catalogs, their titles shine like stars in the firmament. PhDs, SDs, and LitDs bespangle the pages as if they were sprinkled as from a pepper shaker. That was not the purpose of this institution's doctoral program, nor has that been the result. The focus has not been upon an entitled class, but upon scholarship directed to the church, in the service of the church. 100 years of doctoral study is a legacy to be honored, and it is a stewardship to be received. And I must speak most personally of my appreciation for this doctoral program. It invested much in me. And it is not merely to this program, but to those persons on this faculty who invested themselves, I must say a word of sincere gratitude and thankfulness. In Proverbs 1, we read, "Let the wise add to their learning." Consecrated knowledge in the service of the church, based upon the impregnable rock of Holy Scripture, is true wisdom. It is a gift and a blessing to the church. On the other hand, knowledge that puffs up, that amounts to pride, that false knowledge that would subvert the truth, such as a curse to the church and to the gospel. Paul instructed Timothy to study that he might show himself approved, a workman that need not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. May all those who study here, whatever our program of study or degree, make that our holy aim. Make that our sacred pledge, to the end that the Church of Jesus Christ may be edified and the Lord himself, the source of all truth, be glorified. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discipline. Amen.